Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost. Stand alongside me and assistant editor Lee Boyce is consumer expert Grace Gorsden. And coming up, energy prices are set to go up for millions from October, just as the weather turns and likely a large proportion of us may still be working from home. Ofgem has raised the energy price cap again. Is the cap another example of good intentions badly executed, or the only way to protect vulnerable people from disproportionate bill hikes? Also today, the death of the landline, the rise of satellite broadband. The current account battle hots up, and Grace has been on the case, as she has been since November 2020. In fact, our intrepid reporter celebrates clawing back over £200,000 for This Is Money readers. But what are her biggest and most satisfying wins, and what is she working on now? Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. From October, households can expect to pay even more for their energy bills. For the second time in a year, regulator Ofgem is raising the energy price cap due to rising wholesale prices. Now, the cap stands at £1,277 a year for those on standard variable tariffs, its highest ever level. And that's an increase of £230 across the year. It's also £1,309 for those customers with a prepayment meter. It will be in October. It isn't now, obviously, but we'll get more into that in a second. So even Ofgem are recommending switching to save hundreds of pounds. So what is the point of it? Lee, I remember way back when the temporary energy price freeze was first proposed by Ed Miliband 8 years ago, derided as Marxist, a gimmick, meddling jiggery pokery by none other than the former and the current prime ministers. Now, fast forward 4 years, the price cap is in the Conservative manifesto. A couple of years after that, ta-da, it is introduced. So firstly, just remind us exactly what the energy price cap is, who it affects, and what problem was it trying to fix?
Essentially, Georgie, the energy price cap is a limit which energy firms can charge people that are on a standard variable tariff, or as you say, on prepayment meters. And that is done by limiting how much they can charge on a unit rate per how much electricity you use and gas. And essentially, what's happened is that this price cap that gets set every 6 months from Ofgem has become more of a target price for the main energy suppliers rather than a limit, a ceiling as to where prices can go. What's happened? So we've had the price cap announced and it's now reached its highest ever level, £1,277, which is £23 more than its highest point before. And it comes at a time in which more people are likely to be working from home, for example, compared to previous years. I mean, obviously, excluding last year, and also in time for winter. That all mix all that into a big pot. And it seems like a bit of a constant PR disaster for Ofgem, who always are the fall guys and look bad when this comes to fruition every 6 months, but especially so every 12 months in October, just before winter, when people actually cotton on that this is going to mean more expensive bills potentially if that limit goes up. The cap is basically there to kind of help households avoid sort of shouldering the burden of rising energy prices. So without a price cap, we don't know what an SVR rate could be. It could be way higher than what this cap is. So that is the one thing. And the other thing is to kind of stop this loyalty penalty when people don't switch away and they stick around on these pricey standard variable tariffs rather than switching into a fixed deal. They could be sort of seeing bills going up and up and up and up because they're not acting. And that's what it was designed to do. And I should also add here, the reason why the cap has gone up is that wholesale prices have gone up through the roof in the last 6 months. Inflation is raging. You know, these are all sorts of things now that are going to start ticking over. And this could actually, things like this could push far more people into fuel poverty, which is something that, you know, we really don't want to see in a country, you know, like this. You know, one should be struggling to pay their energy bills. And actually, it hits vulnerable people even more, I would argue, than others, because people that are on prepayment meters tend to be people that have fallen in debt with their energy in the past and can't switch off of it. And their default tariffs are even higher than regular customers. So The advice is, if you can, switch, but not everyone can switch. You're best off looking at a price comparison website. We've got one our website, which is through Compare the Market. You just tap in your postcode and see if you can save money. Should also add that this cap isn't like a set price. It's like an average price. So you might be paying more than that, or you might end up paying less than that, depending on your usage, depending on your household size, all of that kind of thing. But there has been research out suggesting that switching and the benefits of switching energy provider are far slimmer than they were last year. And that's because there is still competition in the energy market, but it's almost like everyone's sort of bunching together a little bit now. They don't really want to be the cheapest. And we've seen in recent years when we've had a competitor that's gone aggressively after customers and offered energy deals that are far lower than sort of, you know, others, we've seen quite a few energy firms go bust, a lot of the smaller providers, because they've grown too quickly and haven't been able to cope, or there's been something like this when wholesale prices go up so much and they just can't meet the difference. So it's a finely balanced thing. The Ofgem price cap is a good idea in principle. It's just there's a lot of people that get upset that, you know, they're going to see energy bills typically go up by this much. It's a 12% increase for an SVR rate, which is high. But Ofgem can't control the markets. It can't control the wholesale energy markets. And it shows our reliance, especially on gas coming from overseas. And that's the thing. And there's lots of things that are in the background that mean these rises and falls are going to happen while this price cap's in. And how much longer this price cap sits in for, I don't know.
Well, the point of it, wasn't it, Lee, to introduce it as a temporary fix while Ofgem have a little think about the market, which clearly wasn't working at the time, and how they can better stimulate competition and for it to be more fair. Now, they're sort of talking the latest it's going to be in is 2023. But talking about competition, I mean, Grace, Lee mentioned they're bunching. If you have a tariff that is, I don't know, let's say £800, and then the Ofgem say, well, we're going to have a cap that's £1,200. You're not going to go, all right, then I'll just stay at £800. You're just going to go, well, I'll raise it a little bit. Why not? Still could be cheaper than the cap, but I'll just raise it. And we're getting that, aren't we?
Yeah, definitely. As Lee said, there was some research done this week that showed actually the cheapest deals are now £180 more than they were last year, showing that the cheapest deals aren't really that cheap anymore. What you were saying about the cap, and that obviously the level is good for a lot of people, and as Lee said, you could be paying more, but the problem is that you're saying, oh well, you know, people might switch. Actually, what experts are saying is the cap doesn't encourage people to switch. In fact, it just leaves, they just decide to stay on it. They trust the government, they trust Ofgem, and they think, actually, if they've put this cap in place, surely it's there for a reason. I'm not going to bother looking around anymore and bother switching, because this is the highest it's going to be. When actually, it's still the best idea for most people to use comparison sites. As Lee said, we have one on our website through Compare the Market to see if you could save. And usually that means moving away from a default tariff and onto a fixed tariff, where the prices will at least be fixed for usually a year. So you don't have to worry about it. But there is debate going on, as there has been for many years, about the actual benefits of the caps and whether actually it does help those in need. As Lee mentioned earlier, for people on prepayment meters, it goes up even higher. And these are the people who are struggling the most with energy debt. And I think for them, it's definitely a very worrying time. And it's not going to be great for them that the price has gone up so much.
Where does the solution lie, Lee? But Ofgem looking at trying to stimulate competition, trying to make the whole system fair. What are some experts perhaps proposing as what could work? Because this clearly doesn't look like it's working. It's probably working for some people, not paying. I mean, Ofgem say you can save £75 to £100 using the cap, but in so many other areas, it seems to have slightly messed up what was already a pretty messed up system.
Yeah, well, you said earlier about Boris Johnson talking about market meddling, and it does feel a bit like market meddling. It's quite hard to get this right. And I think, actually, you think about, you know, some of the people at Ofgem that have been trying to think up solutions to do this. They've had a fair few years to do it. And at the moment, we've not heard anything that's kind of concrete that could replace this and could happen. I mean, the real crux of it is to encourage people to switch. Now, people do switch their energy bills far more than something like a current account, because they don't really have as much loyalty to an energy firm. We've had this before. You don't get better quality energy and you don't get better quality gas. It just comes into your house and you just use it. What you do have is obviously better levels of customer service at some energy firms, and others have, you know, better apps and all of that kind of thing. But to the average person, they don't really care about that. They care about getting their energy at the best possible price. And, you know, the research that we've got a table in our story today, suggesting, showing, you know, what the best deals are at the moment. And you still typically, there were some that are hovering around £1,000 mark. Obviously, that's a good few hundred pounds less than the energy price cap. But as Grace said, people see it as a price cap. And I don't know about trusting in the government, but they would definitely think that something like an organisation like Ofgem would be looking after the best interests of households. And to a degree, they are, because this is the cap. They don't control wholesale prices. You know, there's nothing that they can physically do about that. That is just the price. That is the unit price that, you know, is being charged. So people need to just, you know, if you are someone who is on an SVR and just an SVT and never thought about switching, then you should switch, because at the end of the day, you could save hundreds of pounds. And if you divide that over, if you pay, you know, every month, that could be 10, 20, 30 quid more in your pocket. But there seems to be, the kind of people that are really, they will just go and switch. They'll just go and do it. And we've even seen the rise of auto-switching sites where basically you just put in your details and they keep flipping you into a new...
What do you think of those, Lee?
Yeah, they're pretty good. But I always get a little bit nervy when there's a middleman involved. I always think, well, where's their cut coming from? As is anything in life. And to be honest with you, when you can just go on to a comparison website, tap in your postcode, tapping, you know, some details from your bill, it's not incredibly difficult. It's the sort of thing that could take you 10 minutes. It's just convincing people to do it and just getting up and doing it. Sometimes household finance sometimes is the most boring place to be, Georgie, isn't it? Again, we've had this conversation before. You know, it's like, I'm only going to save 50 quid if I go and switch. But 50 quid is 50 quid, and yeah, you might end up with 300 quid saved. So that's the thing. It's just worth getting out there and having a look. And it's never been simpler, and there's never been more, you know, competition and that kind of thing. So it's well worth doing. My worry is, my fear is that it is the vulnerable people. It's the older people. Yeah, they get a winter payment potentially, and, you know, that kind of thing, and help, and some people who are poorest in society, you know, can get one-off payments and things. But it's the prepayment customers that I feel the most for, because, you know, it's nothing good about being on a prepayment meter anyway, and to see that cap go up even more than people that are on an SVT, I think it's a worry. And I think, given that this is the highest the cap has ever been, it is a kind of worrying winter, I'd suggest, for money.
The timing coming up does suck a little bit, doesn't it? When you think, you know, end of furlough, end of the universal credit uplift, you know, this is going into winter. As I said, some people still working from home, so you're probably going to be using more energy. It just seems to me very bad timing. So, yeah, especially the prepayment meters, it's a bad situation.
But it's every 6 months, and I guess at the end of the day, we could be sitting here in a year's time and the price cap might have fallen by a couple of hundred pounds because, you know, wholesale prices have fallen, and we could be saying, oh, the price cap is pretty good. I mean, that is...
But it doesn't help people now. Yeah, that might be the case, but it doesn't help those people now who are staring down the barrel of a £150 increase.
It does not help those people now. No, you're totally right. And I don't know, as I say, I just think people, maybe this will be a wake-up call for people that haven't ever switched before to go, do you know what? You know, that does sound really expensive, like £1,277. You know, that's quite a lot of money over the course of a year for something that is completely essential. And hey, I'm not even joking. I've had this discussion with my wife in the last month or 2 months where she's been talking about putting the heating on. Because it's been quite a cold summer. I'm actually sitting in this room here right now thinking I'm a bit cold. You know, so
grab a jumper, Lee.
That's working from home, isn't it?
Isn't it?
But yeah, that is the very nature of a price cap, Georgie, and what replaces it and what happens in future years, I don't know. But all I can say is just encourage people to have a look around, switch, see what you're paying. It's one of those things, again, have a look per unit cost, all that kind of thing. Sounds boring, But if you work it out as an hourly wage and you spend an hour on it and you end up saving a couple hundred quid, it's not bad, is it?
Lee, I was just thinking in the shower this morning, as you do, about the time 2 years ago. I actually wrote about it, I think, for This Is Money. Or you might have written about me doing it for This Is Money. When I went to stay with my dad and started opening his bills that he'd not opened. That's kind of how I roll, just opening my dad's bills, because he wasn't going to bother. And within, I think, 15 minutes of three things, I remember it was breakdown cover, energy bills, and I think it might have been his broadband, I saved him £700. Do you know what he bought me in return? A Derby County hoodie, which is fine. You know, it's not £700 worth, but it was, you know, I take that, Dad, thanks. But yeah, it really doesn't take long. And I wasn't sure, and Grace, I'm going to ask you about auto-switching just really briefly, because I wasn't sure about it at the time, but actually it worked for my dad, because let's be honest, you know, I mean, as much as I would like to go down there and sort out his bills, you know, every year and make sure he's switching to the thing, you know, I will forget, you know, I have to remember my own bills. So it worked for my dad to be on something like that, so he doesn't have to think about it. But it took that. So I would urge anybody who's got relatives, and they have to be really elderly relatives, you know, to just to make them aware about switching and make them aware that it's going to be okay. I mean, I still haven't cracked my mum, and I think she's been with British Gas for about 347 years. I think it might actually be 37 years. But anyway, either way, Grace, your thoughts on this, because I saw you nodding along.
Yeah, auto switching is interesting. I've written about it before. I know there's a lot of people who are dubious about it, because obviously the point of it is it moves you to the cheapest deal. But a few years ago, maybe a year or so ago, there was so many smaller challenger suppliers collapsing. There was like one, maybe two every month that we were seeing. And a lot of these auto switching sites were moving people to, you know, the lowest price, which was challenger suppliers, which ultimately failed, leaving them in a bit of a precarious situation. Obviously, they then had the, you know, supplier of last resort that Ofgem put in place. So they're not left without supply, but it did mean it was an inconvenience for them to then find somewhere else to go find the best deal. And fortunately, we haven't seen so much of that at the moment, probably because there were so many that left the market all in one go. But that was one of the problems with auto switching that I heard from readers and even experts in the industry saying that they weren't trusting them. And also some do charge a fee. Some it's a low fee, some it's a bit more, but I do think that people object to paying for a service when you can do it yourself. Yeah. I mean, it does take a lot, it's more manpower. You have to, you know, put some hours aside in the evening to do a bit of switching, or well, not even hours, a few minutes really. But yeah, some people didn't want to pay that fee, which I do understand. So I think if you are someone who's older, perhaps auto switching could be great. And, you know, in the long run, even if you're paying fees, you are saving money. But at the same time, I can see why some people are dubious about them.
Yeah. Reminds me to ask my dad how it's going for him. Talking about Pa, the last time I used a landline, I think, was at my dad's a few months ago. He lives in this mobile black spot in deepest, darkest Sussex, where the only access to the outside world is a landline phone. I mean, we've now discovered Wi-Fi calling. It's marvellous. But it's not merely a question of usage. Grace, you've been looking into this. Apparently the tech behind landlines is reaching the end of its life. It's becoming increasingly costly and difficult to maintain. So could it be on its way out for good? I mean, it's pretty injured at the moment. We're not really using it that much. But what will replace landlines, especially in the office? So there's expectations or predictions, Grace, that the office landline will become a thing of the past by November 2028. Grace, that seems rather specific. November. I mean, December 2028? Anyway, the point being, is it going to be?
Well, there is much debate about this, but a business communication service company did take a look into it. Actually, Ofcom figures show that business landlines, not necessarily residential landlines, have fallen by nearly 400,000 in a year to just under 5 million offices having landline numbers now. And this is way below 2013 when there were 8 million. So nearly half. This company has basically used those figures and predicted that this drop is going to continue by a couple of million every couple of years up until November 2028, when there will be so little that they're basically extinct. Whether this is true or not, I mean, we can't say. as you were saying, the reason for this is what the landline relies on at the moment is this sort of old analog network, which is going to be quite costly to repair, maintain, or replace. And so basically, not just offices, but people like myself as well, I don't have a landline, never have. And if I do use calls, I use Wi-Fi call on my phone. It's basically being replaced by something called voice over internet protocol. And this means that people will be making calls as they would normally, but instead of using cabled analog networks, it will now be via the broadband instead. This is obviously quite helpful for a lot of people, as more people have broadband and more people work from home and don't have access to their office landlines as they would normally. Whether the office landline will really become extinct, I think, is a topic of discussion, with some experts saying yes, especially with the rise of Zoom, Microsoft Teams, which were spurred on by lockdown and the pandemic and seemingly are here to stay. Whereas others say, actually, no, there will always be businesses that rely on a landline and may not have broadband. For example, they pointed to pubs and cafes, which still there are some pubs you go into that don't want you to have Wi-Fi, and they rely on their, you know, their landline phone to make a booking and all that. I personally think that the use of landlines will dwindle even more. I can't see that there's going to be loads and loads of firms using them. I think they're going to have to update them. But at the same time, someone like my grandma, who still relies on a landline, she's not an office, she's at home. But, you know, for someone like her, especially during the pandemic, it was definitely absolutely essential. So I wouldn't, you know, I can see both sides of it, really.
I went into one of these pubs that ban phones and all that sort of jazz. I thought it was just a trendy London thing, but it's not. It was in North Yorkshire. Lee, this is, it goes to, I guess, you know, the argument that we have about cash, although it's obviously slightly different. Will it ever really become extinct, do you think, landlines? As much as, I mean, I'm with Grace here. I don't think I've ever had a landline, except, you know, when I was at my mum's, when I was still living there as a teenager. What is your view?
Well, this is one of those things where you have to have a landline to have broadband, long and short of it. And I've had this argument with Ofcom in the past, where one part of the bill that always seems to go up, no matter which telecoms giant you're with, is landline costs. They tend to just keep ticking higher and higher, and then it's inflationary linked and blah, 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 blah. But the cost of keeping the network moving and working is expensive. But the amount of people that are making landline phone calls, especially our generation, is small. I've had a telephone here for 5 years in this house. It's an old-fashioned rotary phone. It's lovely. It's like a gold phone picked up from an antique shop. It rung the other month for the first time. It made me jump out of my skin. I was sitting in the lounge and it rang, and I was like, what is that? It's the phone, and it is so loud, it actually scared me. And that just goes to show, you know, how much that landline gets used. And as Grace says, I mean, things like WhatsApp, I mean, lots of people have WhatsApp, and they can make phone calls over the internet. I can speak to people around the world via my Wi-Fi connection, you know, and it makes a lot of sense. I remember having this conversation with you recently, Georgie, about mobile telephones. Mobile data, pretty much all offers now are unlimited minutes, because people just don't really use their minutes. You know, you don't need to really cap it anymore, because no one, I don't say no one, you know, some people do make a lot of mobile calls, but I fall firmly in the
miserably
category as someone that doesn't. I absolutely hate speaking to people on the phone. I'd rather see them in person. But then ultimately you've got that residential aspect of it, and then you've obviously got the office side of it. You know, we've already had a lot of pressure on offices in the last 18 months as to how many people are going to be going back, and will a lot of people be working from home. Actually being able to rewire calls to home is probably quite useful, I would suggest, for a lot of people that are working from home. I actually used to work for a business telecoms firm called XLN Telecom, which was based in Vauxhall. And it was a small business provider of phones, especially with things like takeaways and cafes and pubs and that kind of thing. I just can't imagine a mass moving away for some businesses, but then for other businesses, I can totally see it. I can totally see video calls on a phone, you know, rather than having to use a laptop and all of that kind of stuff. So there seems to be like a bit of a seismic shift towards as technology improves. And fundamentally, running landlines is expensive, and it's becoming more and more expensive. I think there's a quote in Grace's story from Virgin just saying how expensive it's becoming to keep up with this old network. And when I read that in the story, I was thinking about all of the old operators that used to put all the wires and connect people, like actually physically.
Yeah,
that's the vision I had. Technology just keeps on improving and keeps on growing. And you think Wi-Fi probably will be the way forward.
Hold on, caller. We're going to stick with tech. Grace, you're going to have to help me out on this one. Satellite broadband. Thank goodness you've done a bit of a guide on This Is Money. It's growing in usage, mostly by people living in rural areas because it tends to offer a more reliable service. But it has high setup costs. I mean, we're looking at £500. Is that right? So look, how beneficial is it? How expensive really is it? So first of all, Grace, go on, do us a favour. Satellite broadband for the layperson, i.e. for me. What does it mean?
Yeah, basically, it's very similar to satellite television. If you want it, you have a dish installed at the side of your house and you will get it beamed in from space as you would a satellite TV from a satellite to your home. It's then hooked up to the Wi-Fi as it would be for normal broadband. But that is how you get your internet, which to me, I even remember saying to Lee, I was like, that's mad. I think that's like insane. I think it's really cool. But yeah, it's essentially really beneficial for rural homes who otherwise have quite poor connection. They basically, it means that they don't have to have cables installed, which as we know with fiber is how you have it to your home. And it can take a lot of time and it's very expensive to have it done. However, satellite broadband is not cheap either. Installation costs are around £500, but for me, just looking around, it can be even more than that. And that is to have a dish paid for installed on your home. However, the benefit of it is that you won't be paying line rental like you would be with normal broadband. And also your monthly costs tend to be on average of a little bit cheaper, not by loads, but a bit cheaper. So you know, there are some pros and cons. If you can stump up an upfront fee to have it installed, it might benefit you in the long term, especially, as we say, if you're out in the sticks.
Any deals out there?
Expensive.
No, no. I think I technically qualifies out in the sticks, don't I?
Yeah. Anyway, that's not London. No, I'm joking.
Yeah, exactly.
There are only really two firms in the UK at the moment that are offering satellite broadband. That's Starlink, Elon Musk's Starlink, and OneWeb. Starlink is only offering the satellite broadband to a few rural communities at the moment. It's not really open for complete anyone in the public to sign up. Similar, OneWeb isn't available to anyone as of yet. However, it will be come this October, it's saying. It's going to launch then, and they have also partnered with BT. So I can imagine there may be a bit of a push come October time for those who think they can benefit from it. They can sign up. Again, there are other firms who offer satellite broadband at the moment, but they are offering the much slower version. Starlink and OneWeb are on the much improved version with speeds of, I think it's around 300 megabits. So yes, that should be available later this year.
I think this is really interesting, Georgie, actually, because when you think about people who are out in rural locations, the thought of getting broadband or a solid broadband connection is actually quite treacherous, because the cost of getting it installed into your home for a company is expensive. If you're just a one-off home or just a couple of homes, you know, spread out, it's way more difficult to get a strong internet connection. And there have been promises made by the government about getting faster speeds, I think by 2025 or something along those lines. Actually, I think there are people that could benefit from this, and they could benefit in the next couple of years if there's more competition. So, I mean, Elon Musk being involved in this area, I think, is vastly interesting. He's hoping to have 500,000 users within the first year. And there has been a UK trial of that since January. I think there's some figures from Ofcom suggesting that there's almost 200,000 homes that are currently struggling with speeds under 10 megabytes per second, which is, you know, not ideal for those people. But there's a large chunk of those people, I guess, that wouldn't rely on the internet or don't really care or it doesn't matter. But again, as generations move on and pretty much everyone wants broadband, you know, it is one way of getting it without having to dig up roads, without having to do all sorts of work. There's a couple of things that I question about it. One of the things being a lag. I wonder how much of a lag there is when it's getting beamed into space and back. Yeah, it's probably minute, but I reckon it might be, especially in its infancy, fairly clear. And you also, you're going to be way more kind of susceptible to like weather events and things like that, because, you know, that's just the very nature of how it's delivered. But those small things aside, the cost, 500 quid, yeah, it's probably going to be a bit more than that, will probably come down, I would suggest, over the coming years as again, competition improves, technology improves. I can see it becoming quite a widespread thing. Mm-hmm. There's not many people that have it in Britain yet. I think there's something like Ofcom said about 27,000 people that have this. And I reckon that might grow. If you are someone with satellite broadband, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a tweet at This Is Money or email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk and let us know how you're getting on.
Now let's talk about some interesting new winners in the current account battle. Now, regular listeners to the show will know that last week I switched. It went through officially 2 days ago. There was a wilderness moment that I had of about 1 or 2 hours when I couldn't use my old card. I found this out in Boots, which was a bit embarrassing. But the money hadn't yet been transferred to my new one. But apart from that, so far, so good. I just have to remember some little bits and pieces that I need to change, but that's okay. Lee, switching numbers. They're up, but still relatively low. Where are people going and why?
Yeah, you're right, George, and I actually alluded to it earlier in the show, didn't I? I should have said spoiler alert. You know, there's way more people that are switching things like energy than they do current account, and with reason, because switching current account isn't one of those things that you take lightly. And actually, a lot of people are happy with their bank, as we were talking about before, and people are nervous about their money getting lost somewhere in cyberspace or direct debits not being switched and all that kind of stuff. But that's where this 7-day switching service has been so great. We've both used it now. I found it simple to use. It sounds like you found it relatively simple to use. I always think this data is actually more interesting about, it's more of a snapshot of what's happening with banks and how they're managing to attract current account customers. So again, we spoke on the show recently about Tesco and M&S Bank exiting the current account market. Supermarket banks have gone. They've realized that to compete, you need to get big numbers current account wise. It's a vital tool to cross-sell other products, mortgages, credit cards, loans, all of that kind of thing. We've got two newish new winners in this battle. And I think it's a really interesting look at the psyche of the British public and what it is that they're after. So Starling Bank and Virgin Money are the 1-2 for net switchers, the amount of people they've managed to attract in from other banks as basically their primary account, right? Yep. Starling Bank offers no bribes. It offers no branches. All it offers is good customer service, and I think it's overtaken First Direct recently as the number one for customer service. So it goes to show you that if you have a good customer service, you have a nice sleek app, it's mobile only,
people and a will go semi-ethical offering. I say semi-ethical because if you look too deeply, you'll find little issues with it, but they do profess to have that. So I think some people who are switching, who have spoken to me about it, took that into consideration. I wouldn't say that's the only one, because you'd probably go somewhere like Tridos, but there is that as well.
Exactly that. And I think actually it is still that, you know, legacy of the big banks are bad, you know, and people are kind of happy to try a new upstart like a Monzo, like a Starling, and to a certain degree, Virgin Money. But Virgin Money's gone down a kind of different route. It does have branches and it does have bribes. So it's like a tale of two switching accounts. The Virgin one was bribing people with a case of wine, which has obviously proven
smart
popular.
Yeah.
For the first three months of the year, you know, they've managed to get quite a lot of people in. Some of the big losers are ones that were offering bribes and perks and things, like Santander. You know, it's 1-2-3 current account, once the darling of the current account world, where we saw so many people switch into it to take advantage of 3% interest and the cashback that was on offer, has slimmed that down, and it's losing customers. Same as TSB, they were offering in credit interest, and obviously that had a bit of bad press a few years ago and things. So it all lives in the memory, and people are willing to switch and give these newer names a go. I mean, I say Virgin Money a newer name, but it kind of is for people. Like, you don't see it as one of the mainstays of British banking, and they're willing to give it a go. And I think it's interesting. And on that note, I got an email from First Direct this week. And
I was going to ask you about this, Lee.
I think it's trying to take on the likes of Starling. So mm-hmm. it feels like, to me, it's making some Starling-esque moves. And the reason why I say that, First Direct, actually, for the first time in the last few months, has been getting a bit of negative publicity about its call waiting times, which has always been its number one thing. It's been a telephone bank. And that's where its origins lie. And people expect to be able to pick up the phone to First Direct and have their call answered within probably 30 seconds. I would say they want to be through to a human within 30 seconds. And that's been the norm with First Direct. I think some of those customer services standards have slipped a little bit because of the pandemic, kind of understandably so in one way. But people, you know, some people haven't been happy with that. Yeah. They're going to be ditching Visa. So most current accounts come with a debit card, which is issued by Visa, so a Visa debit. They're moving over to MasterCard, which is the same as Starling. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, it alluded to, this is an email I received as a customer, by the way. This is not an email, like a PR email. This is just something that I've received. And it alluded to the fact that switching over to MasterCard will make it easier to make improvements to its app. Which I thought was quite interesting, which makes me think it's trying to put some more glossier features in there. Because Starling is jam-packed full of little app features that people love and like. And it's even going as far as putting the debit card number on the back of the card, just like Starling does. Because apparently, I can't read. Do you know what? I can't read the numbers on my First Direct card, usually after about 3 months. So it's a black card with silver numbers on it. And it's
usually after about three drinks.
It scratches off and it's really hard to read. I actually find it quite difficult to read. And I reckon there's quite a lot of people find that hard to read, especially if you're doing some late night shopping with the lights dimmed down because your mm-hmm. child's asleep and you're trying to kind of see what your card number is. So it argues that having the number on the back, you know, helps it make it clearer and last longer and all that kind of thing. But they're just little bits and pieces to me that make me feel like they're trying to get that crown back off of Starling. It's an interesting battle. I think that now, where I was thinking it was Monzo versus Starling, I'm starting to think now it's Starling versus First Direct to be the kind of best app type bank. It's a really interesting space, Georgie. I find it fascinating. I think it's a very interesting part of our personal finances.
It is indeed. I kind of think the tech, it is all very interesting in the apps. I mean, you're right. I've just got Starling, so I can see exactly what's there. It's a very different way to bank. I think for a lot of people, and I've spoken to quite a few people about this recently, First Direct, they can't get over the HSBC link. I do appreciate, Grace, this is turning into a show about my folks, but I remember I told my mum that I was switching to Starling. I think she said, darling. No, not darling, mum, Starling. And she was like, who are they? And I said, well, have you heard of Monzo? She's like, is that a bear on a TV show? No. Tridos? No. Like, she had no idea. And she was like, are you sure your money's safe, Georgie? Are you sure? I mean, the reason I picked Starling is because it's just done so well in every kind of customer survey, you know, 3 years in a row, winning all the best British banks. That's kind of why I moved away and I wasn't happy where I was at the time. But should you switch?
Yeah, I mean, if you aren't happy where you are, or if you see another bank that's offering a better deal, or even if they're offering 12 bottles of wine, that really is better than nothing, I would say. I would say I'm really not the best person to ask about what's best, because I have never switched. I'll be completely honest. I've been with the same bank forever. And the reason being, they've been great. One time I got my card stolen and someone spent loads of money on my account and they returned it within a day, less than 24 hours. And that's the sort of bank that's what you want to rely on. Once I knew that I was safe with that, I didn't really want to switch. However, talking of alternative banks, my partner is much more adventurous and he has recently joined Triodos based on their values. He looked into his bank, which I shall not name, and didn't like where they invested a lot of their money. Thought it was very unethical, really wasn't happy with it. He also, someone has never switched, but he thought now was the time. And he's had a great experience so far with Triodos. He has found the customer service really helpful. Anytime he's applied for a new card, it's come within the next day or so. So I think definitely. If you think there is another bank out there that can offer you better rates, can offer you free wine, free experience days, whatever it is, I think it's definitely worth switching. And as we said, it might not be as quick as energy switching, but it's certainly not that difficult these days. It's really not.
No, indeed. I wouldn't always be bribed by the wine, but yes, it is a sweetener, I suppose.
I think I would be, sadly.
Yeah, that's okay, Grace. It's okay. What's interesting, I guess, with Tridos, looking at the figures that Lee, you were mentioning earlier, before we move on from this one, is, you know, while they are quite niche and, you know, they don't have the biggest number, actually have the smallest number, it looks like. Very few people were leaving them, which I think is also quite a nice measure.
That is definitely a stat to look at, Georgie. Yeah, if they're not leaking customers, you know, it probably shows that they're doing things right. And actually, they got a net gain of more than 1,000 customers, which in the grand scheme of things doesn't sound like a lot. But I think out of all the banks that are listed in this, Triodos are probably the ones that are a sort of bank that not that many people would have heard of. Outside, you know, we've got our views a little bit skewed because of the industry that we work in, and I've heard of Triodos forever. But if I went and mentioned Triodos to my partner, or if I went and said it to my parents, or I can guarantee they would say, don't know what that is. And actually, maybe it's time to give them a bit more publicity. And thinking about this and talking about this, I think it's time I did a recap about Triodos and what it offers and what it's doing right. So sometimes the podcast inspires, Georgie.
It does indeed, Lee. It does indeed. Right, I'm going to talk finally now. Since it launched back in November 2020, This Is Money's new column, Grace on the Case, has managed, I can't call it new anymore, but it was at the time, but it's managed to claw back a grand total of £205,676 for its readers. So let's look back at some of her most satisfying wins. But before we do that, Lee, this is impressive, isn't it? 200 grand since November 2020.
It's been incredibly impressive, Georgie, and it's been a real great new series, I would say, for This Is Money. It's really added to, like, you know, some of our regular stories that we have and regular features that we've had in the last sort of 10 months. I think it's been brilliant. So the variety of the cases that Grace covers is just extraordinary, and what people write in and tell us about, I'm sometimes blown away with some of the customer service or lack of customer service that some companies that we use provide. And I should point out here as well that Grace focuses on one reader and then has a bit at the bottom, a kind of hit and miss. So we have a little section in there where people can write in their positive experiences with customer service. So we're keen to also highlight, you know, that there are companies doing things correctly as well as badly. It's always I hate having to step in as a journalist. I hate having to get involved. I'd rather a company just did the right thing without any kind of media involvement. Actually, maybe that would mean some of us would be out of a job, but you know what I mean. I sometimes think logic just dictates, and you say, why didn't you just do this in the first place? All you've done now is got this into a case for us. And I think Grace has done great. This was all dreamt up, I believe. Grace might tell you the story differently. I think over a bottle of wine in a pub. And I think it was
the
where
best
Grace
ideas come from, Lee.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where Grace on the Case was born. And it just helps that Grace's name rhymes with case. It's been brilliant. And she'll tell you about some of the cases that she's got involved with recently. But they, as I say, the variety is staggering.
Do you know why I like Grace on the Case? It's because I agree with you. Look, I had a reader get in contact with me. They'd spent 11 months trying to get their money back from a holiday firm after it was cancelled. They were bang to rights. They were absolutely bang to rights. They should have given them the money. It took them 11 months, a lot of stress. It took me one phone call. And I just thought, why on earth has it taken me one phone call, two for them just to suck up to me a bit more, to get that money back, which is about £4,000. But the great thing about Grace is you actually tell people what they can do it themselves. And I think that's the difference between this your article, Grace, is yes, you do, you're a journalist and you go in there with the big, you know, This Is Money, I am, you know, sort out the case. But you're honest when actually the customer's not going to get money and the company is sort of in the right, but you also help people as well. So I think that, you know, do it themselves. Let's talk about some of your most satisfying wins, the biggest wins, the cases that really stick out, the heartbreaking ones as well.
Yeah, just to add to that, I've had readers say to me that they have seen my stories or even sent my stories to companies and then got the positive result without me having to get involved or other journalists, which is really satisfying and good to know. So I would recommend other people, if they're struggling, they can always contact me or This Is Money. But if they want to try that as well, feel free to CC me into emails. So talking of wins, satisfying wins, big wins, by far the biggest win was actually a recent story. And it was a really sad one, actually. It was a young woman who lost her husband suddenly, left her as a single mother with two children. She was struggling financially since the death of her husband. And the life insurance policy they held with Legal & General was due to pay her out over $100,000. She waited months for the payment, you know, putting it down to the coronavirus pandemic, thinking, you know, there's delays, there's lags, I don't want to push too hard. But it got to the point after a few months where she said, you know, enough is enough, got in touch. And it turned out they had just never received her husband's medical records, but had never asked or told her that they hadn't received it. With this one, when it comes to any sort of death, you have to handle it as sensitively as you can. So I contacted Legal & General and said, you know, if you hadn't received the medical records, why would you not have told, you know, the widow? I don't understand where the delay in communication came. Either way, it was very quickly sorted, fortunately, afterward. And the wife did confirm that she received the payout shortly after, which was quite a relief. But I think with stuff like that, it is really unfortunate when, as you say, journalists have to get involved, because this is the matter of her family and her husband's death.
What a devastating time. What a devastating time to have to go through.
Really is the last thing you want to have to be worrying about. So yeah, that was the biggest one, I would say. One of the most satisfying ones, I'd have to say, it's really not a big win at all in terms of monetary value, but it's more the principle of the matter. So there was a reader whose clothes parcel had been put in her bin by Hermes. I think we've all probably experienced, perhaps not that exact situation, but something similar, frustrating, yeah, with a delivery firm. Hermes confirmed they no longer do calling cards, so they don't put anything through your letterbox to say, you know, we've been here. Her email went to her junk box from Hermes, and, you know, as she said, she doesn't make a habit of searching for her bins for no reason. So she got in touch with Hermes and they said, actually, no, you know, we've done what we were meant to do, nothing you can do here. The clothes firm said, no, you know, we sent you the clothes, not our fault that Hermes put it in the bin. And the bin was taken away by the bin men the same day. Fortunately, after we got in touch, she did get a refund from the clothes firm. Not from Hermes, though.
That's really fundamental, because your contract is with the clothes firm. So actually Hermes was sort of right, weren't they? How did the clothes firm come back to you and say that's not their problem?
Yeah. So the retailer initially got back to me and said, you know, we've been contacted by this customer and this is the situation. You're right, the retailer, the contract is always with the retailer. Fortunately, they changed their mind after Hermes, I believe, got in touch with them as well as myself to say, well, we don't want to pay out, so you're going to have to. And as you say, it's their right to. But with things like this, whilst it is the contracts with the retailer, Hermes should definitely have done more.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of, if you're going to leave something in a safe place, don't just put it in a bin, I think is possibly the main thing.
Yeah.
You know, neighbours.
Well, that's the thing, you're supposed to write where it's a safe place. If you haven't said that that's okay to be a safe place, again, it's not your fault. Absolutely, they should. And what a stupid thing to do, putting it in the bin. Seriously.
Incredibly stupid, but certainly not the first instance of this happening, and definitely won't be the last. So don't want to tell people to check their bins, but if you know there's a parcel coming, yeah, maybe keep an eye out.
What I will tell is clothes companies, don't use them if they continue to do that. So there we go. Let's hope they did something about it. Another one, Grace, before we leave?
Yeah, so one more that was actually talking of satisfying wins. This one was also quite a sad one, I think. It was a man with learning difficulties who had his support work around. His support worker said he doesn't generally help with his finances, but noticed some inconsistencies on some bills. Turned out this man had been paying Sky for his broadband and TV twice for over a decade. So two different sums of money coming out of his account for two different Sky accounts for 10 years. It happened when he moved house 10 years ago, and Sky had failed to change this on his records, essentially charging him for the old house still, even though they could see that it hadn't been used in 10 years. The support worker got in touch with Sky, explained the situation. They admitted fault, but of the £8,000 he was owed, they would only return just over £1,000. So leaving a vulnerable man £7,000 down is just not good enough. It's not right. It's not fair, especially when Sky were at fault to begin with. Anyway, a lot of back and forth with Sky about this. They had to investigate. But fortunately, at the end, he got around $7,500 of the money back. So the majority of it back. But yeah, things like that. Very unfair, very unjust, and they were at fault at the end of the day.
Indeed they are. Right, Grace, well, we could go on all day, but we don't have the time. What can people do if they've got any question, anything they want you to investigate?
They can contact me at grace.gausden, which I will spell, it's G-A-U-S-D-E-N, at thisismoney.co.uk, or the editor's inbox, editor@thisismoney.co.uk.
Excellent. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, apart from Grace on the case there, anything you'd like them to look into, Lee, I know Grace has just said the email address, but is there any other way to get in contact?
He's stolen my thunder. I don't know.
I don't know what to do with that. Like, you know.
Can I just say quickly before I give those details, how passionate. I just love Grace's passion for that, that series. It's great. And those stories and really helping people out. And fundamentally, that's what This Is Money is all about. It's all about helping people fight back, get their money back, take on companies, whatever size, and get them to do the right thing. And I think that epitomizes everything that we do at This Is Money. So just, I think that passion really came through here on the podcast, and that's why I really wanted to highlight it today. So well done, Grace. Yeah, you can get in touch with us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at This Is Money, and you can also comment on the podcast article, which will be published. You can just go in there and get in the comments and say what you want in there.
Yeah. And also, hi to everyone who contacted me on LinkedIn this week, saying they like the podcast. You can also contact me on LinkedIn and tell me you like the podcast. Less so if you don't like the podcast. But anyway, if you do like it, why not also rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.